This podcast is Breaking Ground, brought to you by the Ground Forum and Ground Engineering magazine. I'm Steve Hadley, your host, and I'll be joined after the message from our sponsor by Richard Fielden of WJ Groundwater and the British Drilling Association.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Breaking Ground podcast. Today I'm joined by my friend from the Ground Forum, Richard Fielden. Richard is the Managing Director at WJ Groundwater and he is also the Chair of the British Drilling Association. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing today?
I'm really good, thanks. So nice to be joined by you and continue our fun and insightful conversations about the industry. I've not learned a huge amount over the years about groundwater and dewatering, and it's great to...
In common with the rest of the construction industry, Steve.
It does seem to be a particularly high-risk area, so hopefully you can enlighten not just me, but some others working in the sector as well. But I want to start by taking you back to the beginning of your career and understand that we've got something in common because you, postgraduate, you actually spent some time working in the piling industry.
So my first employer was Norwest Holst, as they were still called in the day. And I was involved in a large basement project in central London, more or less straight out of university. And it was the perfect first job because I had big machinery around me and we were digging a big hole. And straight away, I realized that big holes in the ground interested me for some reason. And then followed a path from Norwest Holst to a piling specialist, Van Elle, in an earlier iteration, and then subsequently to a combined piling and site investigation outfit who back in the early 1990s was still largely reliant on cable percussion rigs. And I found myself in a lot of back gardens in West London, putting shallow piles in for housing extensions and garages and rich man's swimming pools.
Right.
And that was sort of following a decline of the site investigation industry, following a sort of boom in the 90s. So this following a boom in the 80s. So this was in the early 90s recession and people with CP rigs were finding everything and anything to do with them. That was how I sort of cut my teeth in the industry.
And it just occurred to me, actually, we've never really seen too much dewatering within pile construction. Obviously, CFA piling gets around it. And when you're doing rotary, if it's a wet bore, people tend to use tremie pipes. But I wonder if anybody's ever considered actually dropping a pump down a hole.
Well, interestingly, some of our biggest projects, most challenging projects, have been related to piling operations. Arup, when the phase two of Canary Wharf was being redeveloped, realized that you could save an enormous amount of bentonite on the piling if you could construct the piles under, in effect, dry conditions.
Right.
So we were set the challenge of dewatering the Thanet sand at Canary Wharf to enable, I think it was Bashy in the day, to construct a large diameter pile in the dry. We managed to do it. And actually what they found was that by constructing the pile in the dry, it actually gave it much more skin friction. So they were able to, it actually increased the design strength of the pile.
That's interesting. Presumably it's because of the residue that would have been left by the bentonite on the shaft.
And I think on the bottom of the pile as well, there was no material to, so it gained extra end strength as well.
Oh, brilliant. Sorry, that was a little aside. That wasn't on the agenda,
well,
but you've answered it.
There was another one, actually, where we were asked to dewater the Lambeth group.
Right.
I can't remember. I think it was probably an iteration of Stent, perhaps, or Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering. And they were trying to form an underream at King's Cross and realised that if there was a sand channel or a silt channel and there was a risk of crumbs falling to the pile base, again, they would lose quite a lot in the end bearing strength.
Yeah.
So wanted to be absolutely certain that the pile was constructed in completely dry conditions. So we went to a great deal of trouble to try and dewater really, really low flow, really fine sand, just to make sure that they had really good, clean under it.
Yeah. So that is something that had not occurred to me that would be used. Maybe in like basement construction, using piles to dewater, let's say, so you can use a contiguous wall instead of having a secant wall and you haven't got to get your cut off. But to actually use it in that way to not only help with the pile construction, but also improve the pile performance is innovative. Maybe it sounds like it's been around for years, but sometimes we need to relearn lessons, don't we? And that's why things like this podcast are so useful to bring these
Absolutely.
Ideas to the fore. So after you're dabbling with piling, you've clearly got excited about groundwater and decided that was a good path for you.
If I had the choice between running a cable percussion drilling rig on a small house extension in West London or a large infrastructure job where, as a subcontractor, we would turn up working for a dewatering company on a large infrastructure project, so Barking Reach Power Station springs to mind, and you'd have this little CP rig towed behind a Land Rover, surrounded by 100-ton piling rigs and sort of huge cranes. And I'd look around and go, we're just the small guys here, but we're bringing something really vital to the operation. And now I found that a lot more interesting than kitchen extensions in West London. So the first opportunity, I took my drilling and sort of piling knowledge to a dewatering company.
Yeah, opportunity is a good word there, because it really set you up, didn't it? In terms of you were in a relatively small business, but I've seen the benefit of this myself in my career. If you're in the right place within a small but growing business, actually, if you've got the right attitude and the fundamental skills, you can go a long way. And do you want to talk a little bit about your
absolutely. So sort of you're dead right. It was at the right time for WJ, and it was the right time in my career. So when I joined WJ, we didn't do any of our own drilling. Everything was subcontracted, and they'd been around for 10 or 15 years before I rocked up, using a mixture of rotary and cable percussion drilling subcontractors. But actually, the drilling is such a fundamental part of the service that it struck me that we really ought to be doing it ourselves. So from scratch, we had to build up a rotary drilling department and sort of equip it from scratch. And yeah, I mean, I hadn't had a lot of rotary drilling experience, so I was learning on the hoof, as it were. Obviously supported. We had some great guys around. You know, our drilling manager particularly was essential to get the thing off the ground.
So you'd have found him in the market.
Yes. He actually came along as a pump installer. And when we went, we turned out, oh, you know about drilling. Oh, well, that's useful. Well, let's talk about this. And I recall, I think, Soilmec, who were relatively, who were still really only interested in providing piling machinery at the time. They were extremely helpful in helping us get off the ground with a small 15-ton machine. And I found that using suppliers was a great way to learn how to do it on the job.
Yeah, they're a great source of knowledge. Shout out to my friend Mark Nelson there at Soilmec, who's today he's given us a little bit of geological knowledge.
I think he was probably there commissioning the first rig. I mean, that was definitely how it went. And that sort of strength of relationship has stretched out, because I think worldwide, WJF purchased probably more than 30 Soilmec drilling machines since then. So, yeah. We've remained a very good relationship with them.
Oh, that's great to hear. And your techniques, I suppose they've developed over time, and as your business has grown, like most businesses, I think we tend to follow our good customers, and whether that's going to new regions or into new markets, it just is quite a soft landing if you've got a sympathetic customer and somebody that's prepared to work with you because of that great relationship.
Absolutely. And repeat business and sort of doing exactly taking that relationship and then looking for opportunities elsewhere has very much been the strategy. Yeah. So when we've seen opportunities overseas, if we've gotten in through an existing relationship with a designer, with a consultant, or with a contractor, that always really helps give you a leg up to securing the job.
Good. So what I'd like to do now is really explore some of the common techniques, and perhaps you could illuminate it with some case studies, if appropriate, of maybe major projects that our listeners would have heard of where they're used. It might not be the case, but let's see how we get on. I mean, the most common method, is it a sort of dewatering, for instance, if you're going to do a basement? Are we looking at the well points approach? Do you want to?
I think in terms of around the world, which technique is most commonly used, it would be the well point. Mm-hmm. Very low tech, easy to install. Often you don't need a drilling rig at all. They can be jetted. And it suits best for sort of sandy, shallow ground conditions. So in South England, for example, along the south coast, it's commonly used for pipelines, shallow tanks, shallow building foundations, and so on and so forth. So you jet a small well in, usually only 1 or 2 inches in diameter, and then you attach it to what would you regard as a fairly typical sort of vacuum type of pump. So a 6-inch diesel pump would do it,
yeah,
which gives it a bit of suck. And that can lower the water in ideal conditions, 4 or 5 meters. No problem.
Okay. So how far is this going? This is going like 4 or 5 meters in the ground.
Yeah.
Itself.
So you'd put the well into about 6 meters deep. If you fiddle around with the technique, you can maybe get better drawdowns, but mostly people would regard 4 or 5 meters, lowering the water by 4 or 5 meters as a pretty good result.
Yeah. But you've got this jet on the end of the pump, pushing the soil to the side, and then lower the pipe in, and then you start the sort of reverse process. You're sucking the water out.
Yeah. So you'll use two different pumps. Yeah. One's going to jet to generate a nice jet to create the hole in the first place that you can place the, usually it's a plastic pipe. Mm-hmm. And then you switch it around and put on a low, usually it'll be a low flow vacuum pump, to take the water out. So they tend to be lowish, aimed at lower flows.
Yeah. But there's a limitation with that in terms of you can only suck the water up so far.
Correct. Yeah.
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 And if you needed to go deeper with your dewatering, can you, is this where you can have a series of these, but you'd have to excavate down and put them in further?
Yep. And I think that probably used to be more common. So deeper excavations, you'd have to have a staged well point where you'd go down with benches. But obviously that requires a very wide excavation at the top. And as the sort of technology of well drilling applied to a construction environment improved, and as sort of borehole pump technology improved and came down in price. I mean, I think that's one thing. Borehole pumps relatively used to be a lot more expensive. So it was a sort of move to, if it was going to sort of below 6 meters or 10 meters or whatever, instead of putting well points in, you would start to use deep wells.
Okay.
So you drill a fairly typical traditional water well, as you would if you were abstracting for a water supply or water source for drinking water or irrigation. So you don't need a particularly big hole. You might be drilling at 10 inch diameter with a 6 inch well liner.
Yeah.
Drop a slimline borehole pump in it, and if in good ground conditions, and of course it's very flexible from very low permeability silty sand to much higher permeability gravel.
Yeah.
And you can adjust the range of the yield of the well by adjusting the screen size and its yield by adjusting the pump size.
Okay. So this is the deep wells.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm just thinking back to my early days here, and we did some soakaways, and we had a problem on the job with the soakaways, because the soakaways weren't draining away. Mm. Now, it wasn't our design, so we were commercially, thankfully, we were okay. But that was all to do with the permeability of the ground. So it's that old thing, is it a clay sand or a sandy clay?
Yep.
And I think in that instance, it was a sandy clay, which obviously for the listener's benefit means that the majority of the soil is clay and therefore would be less permeable and the water wouldn't drain away. And that must be something you're encountering on a daily basis, making decisions whether it's going to be able to drain in the water from a wider source, because it might be that you've pulled in lots of water, but that's only around, let's say, a meter annulus around the pump.
Absolutely. I mean, the permeability is everything. And the better you understand the permeability, the higher the degree of confidence that you can apply to a particular site. I mean, back in the 1990s, I think dewatering had a bit of a bad reputation as a dark art, and people tended to be quite opaque about things like permeability, total flow, what the drawdown would be. And it was all a little bit, and there were plenty of case studies of projects gone wrong when those calculations didn't work. Since then, I mean, if you do a pumping test, and I think the cost of a pumping test versus the overall cost of a project has come down. If you do a pumping test on a site, that would give you an extremely high degree of confidence in what's going to happen. And you can design the system easily to within a few percentage of what you're actually going to achieve. So the well numbers, the flow, all of that can be accurately determined before you actually start work. And everything comes around the permeability. I mean, that is increasingly more important as environmental legislation requires dewatering. Didn't used to require any permission. You used to just go and be able to do it. But since last year, the Environment Agency require consent to abstract, and they need a lot more information if you're going to discharge to watercourses and so on and so forth. And generally, the key figure is how much you're going to pump, how much you're going to charge, how much you're going to discharge.
Yeah.
And unless you really, really understand the permeability, you're sort of guesstimating.
Yeah. So what you were describing there was, to me, it felt a bit like we'll do our preliminary load test and then design the piles off the back of the load test.
Yeah.
You're performing that permeability test and working out, well, that well's that big, I can take out this much water per hour. I know the hole's this big, and therefore I need this many pumps. How easy is it to go a step before that and say, do a calculation to work out how many pumps you would need without the field trial?
It depends how familiar you are with the soil and the site conditions at any particular given location. So you can generally stick a finger in the air, Steve.
Okay. So empirically based, I think, is the terminology. But I think the market is slightly different in terms. I must have a broader understanding than this and an appeal. So apologies to you and to the listeners. But you work on a design and build basis, a bit like the piling industry is my reference point.
Outside of the UK, 95% of our contracts will be fixed price lump sum, where we take the risk on everything. That means that you do have to have a really good understanding of the ground conditions and what's going to happen. And you need to understand what the risk is of that thing not happening and therefore, what the remedial measures might be. Partly because ground conditions in the UK tend to be so variable, partly because we tend to look at the very deep stuff, where obviously, and the deeper you go, the more uncertainty you have on what's going on in the ground. And because of the variety in the ground, and also because the requirement to so accurately predict the outputs from the dewatering and the inputs. So electricity costs, for example, the number of wells, all of the components that go to make up the cost. It tends to be a lot more common to work on an NEC style of contract with an element of remeasure. So between the designer, the customer, who's usually a construction company, and the dewatering subcontractor, a baseline will be established of, well, this is a good starting point, and then you can sort of work it up. You have methods to remeasure if you need to.
I like the sound of that.
But as I say, typically outside of where people aren't so familiar with an NEC style contract, we take all the risk.
Okay. And could you just tell us maybe about some of the interesting schemes? I know you've been involved with many major projects over the years, Richard. Maybe highlight some of the more challenging ones. We all interested to hear about when things go wrong, aren't we? But maybe you won't be able to quite give us all the detail on those particular occasions, or perhaps when you came to the rescue.
Indeed.
Maybe that would be a better spin on it.
Indeed. I mean, I think we were lucky enough to, and I think it was right place at the right time when we got involved with Dubai Airport. Which for me, it was a highlight of my career because it was our first real opportunity to go overseas. And in the early 2000s, the Dubai construction market was still, there were plenty of British businesses there. So when we turned up, we weren't completely unknown. People had heard of us, and there were sort of some strong connections between companies like Balfour Beatty, Lang were there, Kier were there. And we established a good relationship with a business called Al Nabuda, who were a local company, albeit their senior management team was essentially expat British guys. And technically, it wasn't particularly difficult. It was just vast on scale. And at the height of the project, I think there was something like 60 piling rigs involved and sort of 10 well drilling machines and 10 kilometers of pipe work and 1,000 kilometers of power cable and all of these hugely enormous statistics. And the problems that we came up against were completely unexpected. We didn't know that the water... We knew it was highly saline, but we didn't know the longer we pumped, the more and more saline it would become. So, in fact, the more saline it becomes, the heavier it becomes. And suddenly everything is having to work 1.5 times harder to lift the water because its specific gravity has gone up because it's super saturated with salt.
What sort of values are we talking, or orders of magnitude?
So I think that it peaked at something like 200,000 parts per million of chlorides. And to give you a comparison, seawater is about 50,000.
Right.
So it's three times the salinity of seawater. So we couldn't understand why the pumps weren't lifting, why they were absorbing so much power.
Would it damage the pumps as well? It very quickly
because it's super saline. So it eats through everything. And we found that the pumps were dissolving in a matter of days. Salt encrustation was appearing everywhere. Everything was burning up. I remember going out on site one night. It was about midnight. I think we were pricing up a variation to the contract, which on its own was bigger than the entire UK revenue at the time. And we stepped out of the office and had a bit of a walk around site. It was 45 degrees at midnight.
Wow.
And I looked out and there's piling rigs and there's everything's going like mad. And you could see the generators that we were using all glowing red hot because they were working so hard to keep pumping this water. So,
gosh.
I mean, it was very exciting and scary all at the same time.
So you had to come up with a different solution, presumably. That didn't sound very sustainable.
We had to learn how to protect the pumps from saline corrosion, and we disassembled them ourselves. We painted them with special resins. We designed rubber boots to put on them. We changed all the fittings from steel to plastic so they wouldn't corrode. And we had to uprate the size of the motors. At the time, we were spending a fortune on air freight because everything was coming from the UK. And no sooner had the Grundfos factory built us 100 pumps, we'd stick it on a plane and fly them out, change the motors, ring them up again. We kept Grundfos busy for the best part of the year. So we learned how to do it. And then of course you have to work out, the baseline that we were expecting. It wasn't this salty. What are we going to do about it? So there was the commercial and contractual problems to get over as well.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if it wasn't identified in the ground investigation, you did have cause to go back to them, but.
Of course, such that it wouldn't have been nice if contracts in the Middle East worked as easily as that.
Hence the lump sum situation.
But yes, yeah, and actually, our customer was we worked together, and it was all resolved.
That's good.
But the main point is the thing got built on time.
You learnt the lesson, and I know you're very much wanting to be more proactive where possible in terms of groundwater solutions than reactive, although it tends to be the case that you're called in when something's gone wrong, doesn't it? I think that's sort of the way it works within your industry.
Yes, yeah, no. So we used to make our living from what we call distress sales, so where something had gone wrong. Often it was, I'm not going to name the large job in Preston. in that instance, it was a D-wall shaft and the D-wall hadn't penetrated the underlying rock far enough. It had only penetrated into the sort of weathered rock at the top. So there wasn't a seal and water just came swooshing down under the toe of the D-wall and essentially the base of the shaft blew. And, you know, that can be a risk to the integrity of the shaft wall, you know, the stability of the whole thing. And indeed, in lively cases, not so in that, but certainly when you're particularly in coastal situations, if you blow the base, there is a real risk of catastrophic failure, which could lead to, you know, very rapid inundation and life can be put at risk. So we're always very cautious before you dig, make sure the water's not going to do something unexpected.
Yeah, I think there's a reluctance within the industry to look at dewatering in advance because people are concerned about how the dewatering process might affect surrounding structures. So will that sort of drawdown effect bring with it not just the water, but also the soil particles as well, and then lead to settlement of the buildings. What would you say to that, Richard?
I mean, there has been an improvement and a better understanding of the relationship between dewatering, excavation, and whether it's diaphragm walls or sheet piles or any other form of physical cutoff. So we tend to see less emergencies. But there is still quite a lot of misconception about the risk of lowering the groundwater leading to surface settlements. The two aren't automatically linked. One thing doesn't necessarily lead to the other. It really does depend on the soil stratification and the type of soils that you're dealing with. We're particularly wary when we see compressible PT type of soil, so organic soils. They will compress when the water is taken out of them or taken from underneath them. And some sort of silts can also settle. But the biggest risk will be the removal of fines whilst you're dewatering, which is why uncontrolled sump pumping, which is the old-fashioned way of doing it, could often lead to problems. Or improperly installed wells. If you don't put your well in exactly right, you might move. You can very easily start to remove fines. And once you've started removing fines, it can unravel very quickly. Mm. There have been a few instances of cofferdams, particularly in around the south coast of England, where soil is mobilized. And you get what's called a piping failure. So a preferential flow path is caused and that can cause catastrophic failure to a sheet pile cofferdam, seem particularly susceptible to them.
Right. And to guard against that, you would use filters and just control the rate. Is there like a recommended rates for extraction, for instance?
I mean, I think, yes, designing the filter is absolutely essential. And nowadays, I mean, we do deal occasionally with customers who will specify incredibly low levels of abstraction. I mean, typically we say 10 milligrams per litre, I think, would be a good target, which if you poured yourself a pint of water and there was 10 milligrams of fines in it, you know, it'd be very hard to identify. So pretty clean. I mean, and that's with good well design and good well installation techniques, there's no reason why you shouldn't achieve that.
You said earlier in the call about how you went out, bought some machinery to do the drilling. Of course, now you're the chair of the British Drilling Association. What motivated you to take on that role, Richard?
I think someone twisted my arm, Steve.
Okay. yeah, sounds familiar.
It was very interesting. When we said, right, we need to get into drilling, it was clear to me that we needed a trade association. We needed to join a club. And at the time, there wasn't a dewatering contractors association. We were members of people like the British Geotechnical Association and the Association of Geotechnical Specialists, but they're not really contractor organisations. So I looked around and I thought, right, drilling, yeah, we'll do that. Let's join the BDA. And I found being a member of the BDA in starting off a drilling company extremely useful. They were a good benchmark for what I should be doing, not just with drilling techniques and equipment and actually forming the hole, but also around training and ongoing professional development of our drilling staff, keeping up with the latest in, you know, safety news and best practice and things like that. And I've been part of the BDA since 1999. So when I was asked, it sort of seemed a logical thing to do my bit to give back to the industry, which I thought had significantly helped, me and my business in developing our drilling arm.
Yeah, and the British Drilling Association, I'm not sure if all the listeners will be aware, it may be slightly different to other trade bodies in that it's not just a group of of contractor members. You've actually got lots of very small members who will be drilling crews that lots of ground investigation companies or clients will hire in to do small site investigations or be a part of a larger site investigation.
Absolutely. So because its roots come from the ground investigation specialisation, that was originally back in 1976 when it was established. It was really a group of ground investigation contractors getting together. And of course, it's broadened. So there's dewatering companies, there's grouting companies. We even get a few piling companies, Steve.
Oh, excellent.
Because it's people who are interested in forming holes in the ground. But there is this incredible range of members from multinationals like Fugro and BAM down to family businesses, father and son outfits, operating just one machine, often as a subcontractor for the bigger members. But yeah, they're all part of the family that makes up GI.
Yeah, and I think it must be tremendously important for those businesses to share knowledge and gain knowledge about safety procedures, which presumably is a key element of the British Drilling Association.
Absolutely. So, and I think safety is at the heart of what the BDA is about. And it's on the front line. It's at the rig where we think that is the most important focus to place it.
Yeah, drilling and particularly cable percussion drilling has been recognised as a high risk activity, and it seems to have existed in a little bit of a grey area in terms of the pure regulations and the use of the free fall. I've had a few conversations with the HSE about it. They sort of acknowledge that it needs to exist, but it's not a perfect solution. Where does the BDA stand on cable percussion?
I think that the death of cable percussion drilling has been predicted and passed many, many times. It always seems to me that it's at least 5 years away, simply because the sheer number of rigs that are operating out there and the reliance that particularly the ground investigation industry in this country has on cable percussive techniques. And for sampling, I don't think it can be bettered. You know, there's a lot of people who still say it's enormously valuable. The free fall issue is a big problem. And if really at the heart of it, it's hard to get cable percussion drilling to tick all of the safety boxes. By implementing everything else that the sort of BDA recommends, it can certainly be safe, and especially in the hands of an experienced, competent operator. And there are some really, really competent operators out there. You know, there's some drillers who can work wonders with their relatively primitive machinery.
Yeah, and I think that's the crucial thing is understanding that the people that you're hiring are suitably qualified, and I know that the BDA audit helps in that process.
Absolutely, yeah.
So clients can feel rest assured, yes, it is a high risk activity, but that is mitigated by having great people doing the job that have been doing it for years and are trained and audited in the right way.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you, Richard, and apologies for putting you a little bit on the spot there, but I think it's an important issue, and it's crucial that we raise those concerns. What are the current priorities for the BDA?
There's two flagship programs in the BDA. The one is the audit, which you've just alluded to, which in the last year has been completely overhauled. So is now a very, very slickly delivered, fully electronic site experience. And we've gone to a huge amount of trouble to make sure that it's internally verified and externally accredited. So previously, it could have been regarded that it was that the BDA were the judge and jury of the audit. But what we've said is no, we'll have it externally accredited so that it's not just what the BDA says, that we're meeting industry standards and legislation, and we'll get someone else to credit it. So the Mineral Products Association are our external accreditor. And every audit that is done is internally verified before submittal for external. So it's very thorough, very robust systems, and it's literally delivered on site. And that has to be the intention is to get, we'd really like to see 100% compliance. So we'd like to see every driller out there audited. We've got some way to go to achieve that, but that is the ambition. The second sort of flagship program is we run in association with the CITB, an apprenticeship scheme. And it looked like the Trailblazers might replace it, but we didn't have a sort of ready deliverable Trailblazer because it requires, as you know, working. I think the FPS have actually managed to get a Trailblazer off the ground.
Yeah, we have. It's just rolling out now. So I think we've got our first apprentices secured, and it's come at a really crucial time for us because...
Yeah, we'll be watching closely. But we were pleased when the CITB said, actually, we'd like you to keep running this if you can get the numbers. And of course, at the moment where there is a skill shortage, and there is a shortage of entry-level candidates into the drilling industry. So typically the path for progression is starting life as an assistant driller or a second man, as it's called. And these guys used to be taken on really as labourers. So they need a program to get them up to speed so that they can then become the future drillers. We have a problem with an ageing workforce. We've had a problem that, you know, the drilling industry, just like a lot of other semi-skilled and partially skilled industries, had benefited from particularly Polish and Romanian staff. So that source has been cut off. So we really, really need to grow our own. So this year, we just started last week, we've got 12 candidates on the apprenticeship scheme. We were actually oversubscribed. I think we could have got more. And the CITB have managed to wangle funding for 11 of them, which is really good. So brilliant. We're very keen that used to run on a 2-year basis. So it takes about 18 months. But the ambition is really to be running that every year. So that we're feeding in, at least 10 or 12 guys. And they, unfortunately, they usually are guys, feeding them in, so they've got a career pathway to become drillers within a relatively short space of time.
Sure. And I know there's more comments because you've recently been interviewed by Ground Engineering magazine, and there was the G100 contractor survey. So there's a few quotes on there. If you listeners want to go and check that out on the website, you can find more information. You mentioned there about the drillers do seem to be guys. Are there plans to sort of address that? I know we're working together within the Ground Forum on diversity issues, but I wonder whether that's something you see as potentially changing, and what part of addressing the skills shortages do you think that can play in the future?
I suspect that so long as the industry still relies on a lot of physical labour, then we're probably rather stuck with the male-dominated side of the operation of machinery. Of course, modern rotary drilling machinery with good equipment handling devices does eliminate a lot of the old-fashioned humping of drill rods and drill casings and things like that, which... I mean, we are trying to do anyway because of the reduction of manual handling. And I suspect that as we move along that pathway, we stand more chance of encouraging females into the operational side. In my career, I've seen a complete sea change in particularly on the engineering, the geotechnical engineering. And obviously we now see a few more women at site level as site engineers. Still not enough.
It seems quite well balanced, particularly in the ground investigation industry. I'm not sure of the exact figures, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's close to a 50-50 gender balance in terms of the engineering side and management side. But it's the drilling. So we seem to be maybe changing the culture around construction and actually women feeling like they can be part of it. But maybe it's, like you say, the physical roles still put off women from entering. It's not that maybe that they can't do it. It's the way that we've all been brought up to fill in certain roles and have certain aspirations that puts them off the idea. I know it's a slightly different culture sort of on site amongst drilling crews to working in an office and a management environment. And perhaps there's still work to be done there, but maybe we need to slightly develop on the way that the machines work and look at how as a society we can start to change perceptions of what male and female roles are.
Indeed, one of our programs that we're hoping to do within the next few months is actually take a drilling rig into a prison.
Okay.
And we will drill some holes, not near the fence, obviously. but the idea is to give people who are currently serving an experience so that maybe we can start to train them whilst they're still serving. So actually when they leave, they're more job ready than they are. I don't think we're going to be doing that in any women's prisons anytime soon, but we'll certainly let you know how we get on with
our
prisons.
Anything that helps offenders integrate back into society and helps address the skill shortage has got to be welcome.
Yeah.
That's tremendous. And another thing that was brought up in the contractors file was about the market. Obviously, it's been a turbulent few years. We felt that as much as anybody within the foundation industry. How are you seeing things? What's the forward workload like for the BDM members?
We surveyed all our members within the last 6 months, and I've never seen such an overwhelmingly optimistic outlook. And everybody's got full order books. People are buying machinery like there's no tomorrow. And that largely seems to be supported by, sort of underpinned by large government infrastructure or government backed infrastructure projects. So HS2 is obviously, still ongoing with the site investigation from Birmingham to Crewe has just got started. There's still ongoing sort of phase 2 and 3 site investigations on the stretch between London and Birmingham. Lower Thames Crossing was an enormous undertaking. I visited the project about a year ago, and I don't think I've ever seen so many GI rigs on the same site at the same time. It was very, very intensive site investigation. And the A9 dueling in Scotland has produced a continual stream of work for particularly for Scottish-based contractors. So there seems to be that sort of has underpinned everything, and the marketplace still seems lively. I'm sure.
Well, that's great news for the filing industry.
I'm sure it'll. I'm sure. I'm not quite sure when it's going to peak, we may be riding the crest of the wave right now. But there's plenty of hay being made while the sun shines.
Oh, that's good to hear. And we spoke earlier about maybe sort of the aging workforce. If we can take the opportunity to bring in more people, train them up, then you're going to be in a good place and hopefully have solved that skills gap when things have calmed down.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's one thing, providing that opportunity for investment in new machinery, I think the GI industry is probably guilty of, because these machines, if you look after them, they'll last for a long time. So people did. So we're probably, as a group, guilty for keeping machinery which should have been upgraded. I think that the GI industry is way behind the rest of the industry in terms of its diesel engine emissions. Mm-hmm. I see very little, implementation or checking to make sure that the equipment being used has the sort of current cleanest type of engines.
You're talking about the NRMM regulations.
Exactly. So in central London and central Birmingham, I suspect we're a bit under the radar because we're not operating on construction sites where the main contractor has an obligation to check the equipment. So we've been lucky, but I think that we really have to look at our dirty emissions.
Yeah, we do all need to develop our kit. I think there are challenges with that at the moment because clearly the chips that go in these engines, there's a worldwide shortage of those. So, like you say, we can't replace the kit quickly enough. I know that there's some sites where the government is giving us dispensation to use older machinery, particularly if it's a relatively short duration contract, which I suppose in the case of your members is quite often. Mm. They will only be in there for a week or two. I think it's something like up to 6 weeks. They're a bit more relaxed around the engine type. And even beyond that, sometimes if you can demonstrate if you've got machines on order, they will waive the requirements. So
none of that helps the primary school next door to your site.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And I think we do all need to progress, but we've got to be aware of the limitations of bringing equipment in. So. Well, Richard, thank you so much for today. We've covered a hell of a lot of ground in terms of looking at skills, looking at the market, and most importantly, understanding a lot more about groundwater and dewatering than we did at the start. So thank you so much.
Not at all. Good to talk to you, Steve.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you do have any questions, please find me or Richard on LinkedIn. We'd be happy to help. There's also additional information that's been fed into the podcast page on the Ground Engineering website. So please check that out. Thanks. Bye-bye.